Blog Talk Radio.
Chatting with Sherry is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They are providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for their creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we welcome author David Farland. He's a teacher, he's a New York Times bestselling author, he's an award-winning author, and he's very accomplished. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hello. It's good to talk to you.
Nice talking to you. Reading your bio, it's like, wow. What started you as a writer? Do you remember what inspired you to start writing, or did you just like naturally go pen to paper?
Well, you know, as a kid, I used to love just reading science books, and I first started writing, I think, when I was about 16 years old. I wrote a book. I just got interested in mammalogy. My brother was in college, and so I wrote a book about the Mustelidae family, which is the weasel family, and did a bunch of research for it. And anyway, that was a couple hundred pages long, and then shortly after that, I wrote a little book on the history of the development of nuclear weaponry in the United States. And so I was already just kind of writing because I would get curious about topics and like to explore them. And then I read Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And I loved that book. I read it probably half a dozen times. And then I started reading other fantasy novels, and I think I was about 16, maybe 17, and I started deciding that I would make up my own fantasy stories, and I was telling one to a friend one day at work, and he says, "Why don't you take all of this crud and put it into a book?" And I thought, yeah, of course, that's what Tolkien did, so I'll just start writing, and that got me started writing at that time. It just became a passion, I guess. I had been really good at oil painting and sculpting, and I loved to make mosaics. And so I was always in some sort of an art, but this was the first time that I ever had one that really I felt like this was my calling. This is what I wanted to do for a living.
Did you read, were you, I know you said you read Tolkien and that's what made you want to become a writer, but were you a reader before you ever got to that point? And both fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah, almost all of my reading was in nonfiction. I thought that I was going to go to school and become a doctor. I was really interested in genetic engineering and neurology and things like that, and biological sciences mainly. And so I planned on doing that. And even when I started playing with writing at the age of 16, I went out after I decided that I was interested in it, went out and I bought a used typewriter and went to the local college and got books on writing and started educating myself on how it was done. And I thought I would probably just go ahead and write stories on the side, maybe write poetry on the side and work on, work on becoming a doctor. And I had a teacher, I think when I was 17 years old. My English teacher had me stay in after school one day, and she said, "We've got a problem." And I said, "What?" And she said, "You're a writer. You don't know it yet, but, one of these days it's just going to start boiling out of you, and you need to learn how to handle it, how to control it so that you can write your novels when that time comes, And I said, "No, I'm going to be a doctor." And she just said, "No, you can't control it." And she was right. I was in pre-med and got up one morning and started, a line to a poem came to me, and I started working on the poem. And it took me like 12 hours. I just blew off classes that day. And for about the next 4 or 5 days, all I could think about was stories that started coming out. And I went to a class. I was thinking about what I should do with it and realized all of a sudden that instead of being a, doctor who wrote on the side, but maybe I wanted to be a writer who doctored on the side or something. So I changed to an English major within a few days. And it took me about, I started writing, and I entered a little short story contest, and I won third place in the writing contest. And I thought, you know, if I'd worked a little harder, I could have won the grand prize for that contest. I thought maybe I should focus on that for a little bit. And I started writing a bunch of stories and entered them into several contests. And my goal was to try to win first place in a writing contest, you know, about a year after my first prize. And I ended up winning six contests all at once. And one of them was the Writers of the Future contest. And I went to New York to have the awards ceremony. We had Isaac Asimov there, and we had Mark Hamill from Star Wars, who was really just huge at the time, and you know, things like that. And so I won the grand prize there, and a couple of weeks later, I got a three-novel contract with Bantam Books, and that just sort of paved the way for my beginnings in the industry.
Were you awarded your prize by Isaac Asimov?
I'm trying to think who it was who awarded it to me, because I just told that story and I can't think. I mean, we had Ray Bradbury was there, and Gene Wolfe, and Orson Scott Card, and Anne McCaffrey. And I remember just being overwhelmed, you know, Robert Silverberg and others. And so there were a number of people there. The person who awarded me my prize, though, was a physicist who was really highly esteemed. I think he was a Nobel Prize winner. I just can't remember his name right now. So I'm having a senior moment. But anyway, the thing is that all of my heroes were writers by then, I guess, is what it came down to. And that's who I remember best.
Isaac Asimov fascinates me, though, because, well, first of all, he was my father's favorite, which he's the one who got me into science fiction, but also because he was so diverse. I mean, he wrote so many books. He wrote nonfiction and fiction. He wrote all kinds of different topics. He was such a, and what's really interesting is all these books on space travel, and he was scared to fly, the poor man.
You know, he was interesting. I remember hearing an editor talk about him once and saying that she needed to get some little books done. They were a group of books for essays kind of things for teenagers. They wanted some chat books on how to write science fiction. So they were trying to figure out who could do it really well and do it quickly. And she called up Isaac Asimov, and Isaac said that you know, she got done. He knew exactly what she wanted, so he sat down and wrote the first chapbook, and then had it delivered to her 3 hours later. And I just thought that was amazing. And the other thing about Isaac that was interesting is that apparently he was really, really good at writing dirty limericks. And so with his friends, when he would send them a letter, he'd usually start it with a dirty limerick.
Oh, God. Imagine keeping that. That would be quite a keepsake.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if he's angry at you, it would be.
In fact, I remember hearing one of his friends said something along the line of, I should collect all of those, and we could put out a book, a new Isaac Asimov book. But, yeah, I think that's great. It's nice to know that he had such a great sense of humor. That's what it comes down to.
Oh, yeah. That I knew because I heard him being interviewed. He and Ray Bradbury were the two people I idolized as a child, were both two.
I loved Ray. He was such a nice, warm, gentle person, you know. And it's too bad more people couldn't have gotten to know him.
I had the honor of meeting him, too. He's a really, really nice man. Very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Very down-to-earth.
Yeah.
Normal guy. I love people that are like that. Just didn't give a darn about any of the classic, I'm a star, I'm a famous person, none of that. He's just right.
Yeah. Yeah, the first time I met him was when I won that Writers of the Future thing, and a few years later, I was at a party with some other authors, and somebody said that Ray was going to be stopping by later, and I thought, oh, I wonder if he'll remember me at all. You know, should I go introduce myself? And anyway, about half an hour later, I was sitting in a chair, and somebody put their hand on my shoulder and said, "Hi, Dave." And it was Ray Bradbury, and he just shook his hand. It was just like, gosh, it was like I'd seen him half an hour ago or something. He just remembered everything, you know. So that was Ray, like you say, just very down to earth.
I love that. There are a few people like that I've met, and he's just one. But he was one of a kind, though. He was the first time I met him, I was at community college. And I was a freshman year. I was very excited because our speaker was Ray Bradbury. And the speech was supposed to be write about writing and, you know, and if you want to be a writer and stuff like that. But really, he just finished a book on dinosaurs, and that's all he really wanted to talk about. And we just had this great chat with him, and it was a two-way chat, even though it was supposed to be a speech, about where dinosaurs are and the concept of it and what happened to them. And I mean, this was in the 70s, so we didn't hardly know anything. It was really, that was my first exposure to him, and he was just so funny.
Yeah, that's the thing about being a writer, you know, you become an expert on these odd little things. You know, you're going to write a book with dinosaurs in it, you better become an expert on dinosaurs, you know. And the funny thing is that very often you discover things that other people just, you know, haven't noticed or have overlooked. Paleontologists and anthropologists are really great at just missing things. And so I always love talking to other writers about just about topics that interest them. You know, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I studied archaeology, and I have to agree. And the other thing about archaeologists, and I am personal friends with several people who are archaeologists, and there's a group that's really open, and they want to know new things and stuff. And then there's a group it's always been this way. This is the way it is. You cannot change it. And I'm like, but that's what your job is.
That's exactly right. Yeah, there's no easier way to start a fight than to start talking about history. I wrote a little historical novel a few years ago, and I was just amazed at the number of people that wanted to jump out of the woodwork and attack you because they thought you'd gotten it wrong, when in fact they were just idiotically wrong, you know. And you always get that people want to have that sense that they're experts in a field when in fact very often they aren't.
It's weird though, because people are strange about things like that. I remember when I was in a philosophy class, I loved my philosophy teacher. He was the coolest guy. And everybody got along really well until towards the end of the first semester when we reached religion. And then the claws came out, and people that got along great up until that point were fighting with each other. And some of us just stood back and watched, sort of like anthropologists. I was one of them. I didn't get involved. I just watched the fight. But there were three or four people who, and he handled it beautifully. I mean, he was like the great negotiator, trying to get people to first calm down and to listen to each other and, you know, do all the things. But I was watching, and it was so weird. It was like all of a sudden they changed. You could almost see them metamorphosize because you hit this area that they're tender about. And it wasn't everybody in class. There were about 20 people in the class. It was just these few people, but it was like almost like a show. That sounds weird.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes it's the people who believe most alike that, have the biggest problems. You know, if you belong to a Baptist church and somebody belongs to another Baptist church down the street, you can have wonderful arguments, you know, about little tiny points of philosophy that are just slightly different. And that's always been a problem.
Really interesting how invested people are in certain things. Not just that. I mean, we were talking about history. People will get the claws out over history or astronomy or anything. You know, it's just that there would be the subject, and people go, "Rawr." I don't know why. It's just this weird kink in the human nature.
Oh, yeah. I loved the book when I was young. I was a teenager when I read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And I don't know if you remember that book at all, but it's a book about a fellow who basically has a mental breakdown because he has a problem with a philosophy teacher who idolizes Socrates instead of Plato. And he's trying to point out how the entire Western civilization has been pretty much devastated because of this one misunderstanding of a principle that Plato taught. And I was like, okay, this is a fun argument, you know, but it pointed out that, yeah, people get really bent out of shape about certain things.
And it's like ancient stuff. And some of the stuff was at the beginning of time stuff. That people will get bent out of shape. You can't really control what happened, and you can't really control that somebody has a different outlook than you do on it, and yet people really want to make the other person have the same opinion that they do. And it's one of the interesting things as a writer, when you're writing a story or a novel or a play, that's part of the drama, is that it can be the tiniest, it's like love. You could have two characters that are friends, and then one tiny little thing that one person does sparks the other person's interest, and then suddenly they realize there's more to the relationship. I think it's sort of the same as that same kind of a spark, but the opposite. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really does. And sometimes, you know, just a little bit of information just changes your entire outlook on something. I'm doing a little research for a book that I want to write here in the near future. It's set in Fiji, and it deals with the first white man who went to live on Fiji. He didn't really go to live there. He was thrown off a ship, but he went to live among the cannibals. And when he did some things that just seemed very strange. There were a lot of stories. People made fun of him back in the 1800s when they heard about his tale and stuff like that, going off to live among the cannibals. And then I went and spoke with some of his descendants, and they explained Fijian customs and stuff at the time. And all of a sudden it was like, no, this guy wasn't a fool. He was a genius. And for example, when he went to live among the cannibals, there's rumors that he had a head injury and that he had to wear a white bandage around his head. Well, the white bandage is a symbol that you're a king in Fiji, in ancient Fiji. And so by wearing that, he actually scared off other cannibals who would have tried to have eaten him because they would have thought that his mana was too strong. And so by putting a white bandage around his head, he basically saved himself. Later on, he went into a village, and it said that historians said that he was too sick to climb this mountain. But the truth was that he stopped a couple of miles before he got to the village and demanded that the elders come and carry him. And that was a sign of respect, to have the people carry you into the village. And that was sort of his way of making sure that they weren't going to try to eat him once he got in there. And just, you know, little things like that. He kept finding little bits of genius that I go, okay, This is really fascinating. The people there called him their wizard, and believed that he had magical powers. And I think he did a lot to ensure that they thought he was magic. But in any case, just fascinating how little details can really, really sort of emphasize the vast difference in the way that we act and react down the line.
And it's interesting because I don't know what it is in the human psyche, but just a teeny tiny little thing can flip a switch and you don't really realize it. And it can be for good or bad, but it's just one piece of knowledge. Someone says something that goes against something, or somebody says something that interests you, and it just completely flips your perception of that person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this weird click that humans have. I mean, I think it starts wars.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the human brain is a pretty complex thing. We usually like to think that we have a brain, but you have two halves of your brain. First of all, you've got a left hemisphere and a right hemisphere, and they're connected by the little corpus callosum, you know, which lets them talk to each other. But then you have a forebrain, you know, where you've got certain logical processes going on, and a hindbrain that homes most of the emotional processes. So you've got, you know, the logic and reason versus your emotion. And we have different lobes where we listen to things, and, you know, some person might be really good at hearing, whereas another person is really good at seeing. And you can have the two people in a meeting, and one will hear one thing and one will see another, and come out with completely different feelings about, you know, what exactly was the meaning of, you know, what happened in this meeting. If you've ever been in a foreign country and you've had to negotiate a contract with a bunch of, you know, with a group of Chinese businessmen or something like that, you know, you can get different people in the same meeting, and we'll all come away with different interpretations of what exactly is going on.
I think that is really a fascinating thing. What was the name of the movie? Majority of One. It was with Rosalind Russell and Alec Guinness and, oh, I can't remember the one who plays his son, but I mean her son-in-law, but he's going into a meeting. They're in Japan just after World War II. And
mm-hmm.
Alec Guinness is playing Japanese. And everybody else, George Takei is in the movie. He's one of his, I think his butler in it. So they're in this meeting, and they're talking, and you really don't hear the insults, but you can feel the frozenness. It was so well written. You can feel the anger of the meeting.
The tension,
yeah, the tension, especially on the Alec Guinness, the Japanese side. And he, as hard as he's trying to fix the situation, Rosalind Russell's son-in-law, he can't. He doesn't know what he's saying that's wrong. And it builds and builds until he just leaves, and he just figures he's going to get fired. And the next thing he hears is that he's like with the State Department, and the guy in the State Department is calling and saying, "Well, I don't know what you did, but the whole thing is blowing up. We're going to lose this thing." And Rosalind Russell, who had actually had a friendship with this guy, and her daughter and he broke it up because they were Jewish American, he was Japanese, and the prejudice and stuff. But she understood him. So she finally said, you found out all of the stuff about what they need, but you didn't understand who they are. You're talking to them like they're other Americans instead of talking to them about within language of their culture. And here's this nice little Jewish lady explaining to her young, well-educated son in love,
yes,
what he's doing wrong. But it's one of the most beautiful movies. If you've never seen it, I highly recommend it. But it takes all what you're talking about, and it puts it in sort of an American perspective of how the ugly American myth, how we're ugly Americans, and we don't even realize how prejudiced and ugly we are when we're facing other cultures. It's really very, I think it's one of the best movies if you want to understand,
yeah,
what we're like.
This kind of thing happens in a lot of cultures where you may have different language levels, different verbs and nouns that are used in, between people of different classes, for example. And so in Japanese, the worst thing that you can do, the worst thing you can say to somebody is they've got a word, kusokarai, which is you dung eater, basically, I guess is the easiest translation. But it's not that you're calling them a dung eater. It's that you are calling them a low-born dung eater from the point of view of a person who's of a higher class. And so it's an insult not only to, you know, to them as being dung eaters, but also, you know, to where did you come from? You know, how low born could you get? How stupid could you get? That type of thing.
It's kind of interesting, too, because if you think about it, Americans have this idea that we're a classless system, which we're not. If you look at it,
no,
if you listen to it, we are not. But
not at all.
Facing,
if you're a movie star, you're not equal to a person who works at KFC or something.
Exactly. Or if you're a really rich guy, you will look down on the guy who's cleaning your shoes, even though the guy who's cleaning your shoes is making a good living, is quite happy. To you, he's a lowly person. It's a stupid thing, but that's, you know, there is a class system in our country.
And you just use the word stupid, and we have,
yeah,
a lot of intellectual barbarism in our class, in our culture, where if you call someone stupid, that's a horrible thing to say. Mm-hmm. My wife works with handicapped people, and I would never want to call somebody stupid. You know, it's just, if a person really is stupid, they can't help it. You know, so quit using it as an insult. I guess is what I try to keep telling myself.
Also, I've actually heard people talk that way, and it makes your insides go ooh.
Yeah. Well, I was in a class years ago, and we had two professors who were going to argue some point. They had to flip a coin to decide who was going to be pro and who was going to be con in the argument. And I sat down with a classmate, and we were going to listen to this debate because it was really about the art of debating. And anyway, we sat down, and the guy said, "Well, who do you think will win?" And I said, really, what I want to know is how long is it going to take for them to call each other idiots?" And he said, "Oh, they would never do that. These were two esteemed professors." And I said, "I'll give you 20. I says, "I'll bet you $20 they do it within 5 minutes." And he thought about it. We bet. And 2 minutes later, I took his $20.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's the way that we do it. When we want to insult somebody in a debate, the first thing you do is you call them an idiot, you know, in one way or another.
Even if it's an elegant way of saying it, it's right to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's like one of the best orators ever and they use really elitist language to do it. You're still being a jerk,
yeah,
by saying it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, we can't all be experts on everything. I have a pretty high IQ, but, if I need help with my car, I go to somebody who's a mechanic. That's all it comes down to. And if I need help with a medical issue, you go to a doctor. And, you know, so we all have our expertise.
I think it's interesting, too, because I love words and stuff. But sometimes when you're really upset, your mind goes blank. Even though
mm-hmm.
you're well read and you studied, you go to school and you work with words all the time because you're a writer. But just because you do all that doesn't, it's like what you were saying about the professors. It wasn't that they're suddenly going to the basic instinct. They may have just blanked out and couldn't think of what to say, and that's what popped out of their mouth. I mean, there's different levels of that kind of thing. Sometimes I don't think people are name-calling because they're mean. Sometimes I think they do it because it just pops out because they don't know what to say.
Well, you know, I used to work as a prison guard when I was in college for a little bit, and I saw a couple of fights where people tried to kill one another or stabbed one another. And I noticed something interesting. Just before people will try to kill somebody, they will almost always try to figure out some way to dehumanize them. And usually it's by calling them a name. And so when we go into battle, for example, and we're fighting a war, we have to have some sort of derogatory term for the enemy. You know, you can call them, you know, Yankees, gooks, nips, whatever you want, krauts, you know, that type of thing. But in every war, there's always been a derogatory term for other people. And I saw the same thing happening when I worked in the prison, that, you know, we try to dehumanize them. And I think that just name calling in general is an attempt at dehumanizing people and trying to at least in our mind, somehow justify their difference in opinion by recognizing that they're not quite human. They're just not on par with us.
Not just that line makes me get all googly. I think what we're talking about is really fascinating, but I want to bring up, you have some stuff that's coming up that you want to talk about?
Let's see. Right. Right now I'm focusing on doing a number of things. I'm working on a book, which won't be done for a while and won't be out for over a year, so I'm not going to worry about too much about that. But I'm finishing up the last book in my Rune Lord series. And beyond that, I've been, you know, working on teaching a lot. I just went and did some videotaping for the folks at Writers of the Future, and we'll have a little online writing course that will be out for free at writersofthefuture.com. And that'll probably be out, I think, after the beginning of the year. It'll be me and Orson Scott Card and Tim Powers talking about how to write a short story. But I'm also doing the same kind of thing with my own online writing workshops. I've helped train a lot of people in writing over the years, and a number of them have become number one New York Times bestsellers, people like Brandon Sanderson and Stephanie Meyer and James Dashner and others. So this has been kind of one of the love of my life is understanding how to teach writing, because sometimes it seems almost mystical or magical, you know, like you can't quite comprehend how people achieve certain effects, or how do you teach that? You know, how do you teach something that's so twisty and ill understood, I guess. So that's been one of my life. So I'm working on doing that quite a bit. So I've got a big writer's bundle that I'm putting together, a bunch of online workshops, and people can come and get those for a really low price over the next few days, weeks, if they'd like to. They can go to mystorydoctor.com and get onto that. So that's kind of what I've been working on lately, is just working on trying to create some really great software on writing.
That's a great thing. There's a lot of, I have a question for you, because there's a lot of master classes for writing. There's a lot of online stuff that pops up on Facebook and stuff for writing. And I tell people, get recommended to classes. Find people you respect, and they'll refer you to things. Don't trust stuff that pops up on Facebook. At least that's my experience. Do you agree with that?
I think there's a lot of things that pop up. And I remember seeing a class just recently where it said, learn to write science fiction. And I was like, okay, so who's teaching? And I couldn't find the name of the instructor. And I thought, well, that's really weird, because there's a lot of really good people who understand science fiction who can teach you, you know. And so, you know, like on my site, I have some quotes from some number one New York Times bestsellers and a few from other new writers. And, you know, I've always got somebody. One of my past students, Martin Shoemaker, is up at number one on the Amazon bestseller list this last month, several times. And so, you know, I've always got people coming along who are new students who are doing good. So I can get cover quotes from a lot of people like that who've made it. But yeah, there's a lot of people out there who are trying to figure out how to make money as being teachers. And my goal lately has been to try to figure out, how can I teach the most people for the least amount of money? You know, I mean, if you edit a person's book and help them that way, you can do it. But gosh, it takes a long time to go through a book three or four times and edit it and stuff. And so I've been looking at doing online classes that people can get very inexpensively and just say, okay, this is a way for me to talk to a lot of people. And I hear from people in, you know, South Africa and Europe and stuff like that who've become bestsellers, and they tell me how thankful they are for my classes. And many times all they do is just get my free writing advice columns, because you can sign up for those on my site too. And that works good too. It's just that if you get into a class, you're getting something that's a little bit more focused on your needs and interests, I think.
I think that's really what's important. And like I said, make sure that there's a referral, that, you know, that there are people that has knowledge as a writer, that's teaching the class.
Yeah.
Or at least be an educator that teaches writing, something that actually makes this person knowledgeable. Don't just go for anybody.
Yeah, there are some fine people, though. I'm just going to have a little caveat. I remember one of the best writing teachers that I ever had was a fellow who just happened to be really brilliant and had taken everything that he could find on writing and put it into his class. And he had actually a really good writing class, even though he wasn't, you know, a best-selling writer or an award-winning writer or anything like that. And then on the other hand, I once in a while will meet somebody who is you know, Hugo and Nebula Award winner who can't teach for the life of them. So I think that there's, I think there's almost a gift of teaching that a person has to have. And I keep aspiring to that, I guess is the easy way to say it. I've had I'm up to around 100 writers just that I know of who are New York Times bestsellers, but, you know, I'm always trying to look for more and figure this whole thing out, because it's a complex thing. It's not just learning how to write. It's learning how the business works, too, is something that a lot of writing teachers can't teach you. And then we get into storytelling versus, you know, just stylistic strengths. And so there are a lot of people who can teach you how to write a beautiful sentence, but can't teach you how to write a halfway decent story. And so you've got a number of different types of things that we have to deal with as writing instructors. And so that's something that occupies an awful lot of my thought processes, I guess.
Well, also that's where the referral part comes in. You know, somebody takes a class and they refer someone. This guy is great, or this woman is great. They really know what they're talking about, and refer you. It doesn't matter about whether they're a best-selling author. It's just that they really know what they're doing and they help this person.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you trust
I was talking to a woman a while back who had taken a class with J.R.R. Tolkien. And just by coincidence, she had taken it in 1957, which was the year I was born. And so I asked her what he had taught. And she says, oh, you know, it didn't really make a lot of sense. And then she told me what he had taught. And I thought, that is the most brilliant thing I have ever heard. And it just went over the top of the head of that author and probably just about everybody else that he talked to. Because he was talking about the importance of a broken narrative. And what he was talking about was a principle that's used in hypnosis that wasn't discovered until 7 years after he talked about it. And so, you know, it's just kind of kind of an odd thing. And anyway, I loved the concept of what he talked about, and thought a lot about what he did and how he did it and why he did it. And at the same time, I've never heard anybody else talk about that particular topic before.
I just think that sounds fascinating. I wish I was alive. I would have loved to.
I would have loved to have been there too, but I think that if I were an 18-year-old college student, it would have gone way over my head at the same time, because, as I said, you know, he was talking about some principles of storytelling that were just that just were unheard of and undiscovered at the time. And anyway, that's going to be the topic of one of my articles in the near future, I'm sure.
It's also I read it in someone's biography, and I can't remember who. They were talking about Somerset Maugham, and they were talking about a lot of different things. But one of the things he was talking about was his writing, and the person in the biography didn't understand one syllable the man said. And then he said, later on, when I matured, because I was only 17 years old, I realized that I should have taken notes, because what he said was brilliant.
Yeah. W. Somerset Maugham was interesting. He once said that somebody asked him, you know, what his definition of a short story is. And he said, you know, sometimes I'll send a short story off to a magazine and I'll get a rejection back from the editor who says, I can't figure out what's going on. And he said, you know, a short story is whatever you say it is. And, you know, when you think about that, it sounds, that's like the worst definition ever. But when you've been thinking about it long enough, you understand that, you can very often see a story in a narrative line that other people don't quite understand, you know, they don't get it. And so, it's whatever you say it is. That's about all you can do.
That's true. It's been fun. We're almost at the end. I wanted to give you a chance. Do you have anything that's coming up, like conventions, book signings, anything else that you want to let people know about?
Sure. My next big convention is going to be at the Superstars Writing Seminar in Denver, Colorado, which will be the first week in February. And this is a big workshop for people who want to break into publishing and they're really serious and they need to understand the business side of it. So we got together a bunch of New York Times bestselling authors, and we only allow New York Times bestsellers to teach there because we wanted people who really understood the business side of it. And not just the writing side. And so it's a really good workshop for people who really want to understand the business side. And I think it's important because I've had a number of students who've gone out and made big deals and, you know, made millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on their books even. But then I've had people who go out with a lot of promise and make really bad moves when they start out. And so they failed because they didn't understand the business. And so I think that an author needs to understand how to write and how to tell great stories, but they also need to understand how to make great deals and recognize that they are in a global enterprise. When you're a new writer, you know, you're writing for markets all over the world, for selling your books into different mediums and stuff like that. So if people are interested in that kind of thing, this is probably one of the best workshops in the country for that. And that's going to be my next big thing. And I'll be talking a lot of conventions here in Utah in the coming year too.
And could you give your website one more time and any social media where can reach you?
www.mystorydoctor.com. That's probably the best place to get to me. I do Twitter under David Farland, but I don't do a lot of tweeting and stuff like that. My my assistant handles most of that, and I just send out announcements primarily.
Okay. And are you on anything else like Facebook or Instagram?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely on Facebook under David Farland. And so you can find me there. My friends list is pretty darn full, but you can be a follower easily enough.
And are you on Instagram?
You know, I put ads up on Instagram and stuff, but I really don't do too much on Instagram.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Thanks.
You have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Okay. Thank you.